It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A bill signed into law Friday codifies the definition of anti-Semitism into law, as critics say that law could stifle free speech.
Governor Tony Evers signed the bill, which would formally adopt a definition of anti-Semitism created by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance nearly a decade ago.
The law can be used to decide enhanced criminal penalties if a person is targeted in a crime because of their race, religion, or national origin. It also includes the definition in anti-discrimination laws.
The bill passed the Assembly 66 to 33 in February. Critics like the Wisconsin chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union and Jewish Voice for Peace Action said in a letter that the move could grant the government the power to label political criticism as discrimination.
Democratic Representative Lisa Subek co-sponsored the bill and spoke in favor last month.
This is guidance that we desperately need at a time when anti-Semitism is on the rise in our communities.
Eric Casper is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and director of the university's Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. Eric, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
What, in practical terms, what changes under this law? How could it be implemented?
Well, the law itself applies under a couple of different conditions. One is when there is a law prohibiting discrimination on the basis of membership in protected classes, including religion. And so this definition could be used when evaluating evidence of discriminatory intent for that type of situation. It also would apply when evaluating evidence of discriminatory intent for enhanced criminal penalties that are engaged in with a motive of against someone because of their membership in a protected class, including on the basis of religion.
Wisconsin already has enhanced penalties for crimes that are motivated by a victim's race, religion, color, disability, sexual orientation, national origin, or ancestry. What does this addition of this particular definition of anti-Semitism add that wasn't already there?
Well, it's a definition that was established by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance in 2016, providing a specific definition of anti-Semitism and providing a list of examples of what would be included in that. It looks like at this point, 37 states have adopted that definition when defining the term. And so there are a number of other states that have gone this route. The question with any kind of definition that would restrict potentially expressive activities is what that means in practice. In short, and the legislation states this, if it is underlying speech that is being restricted as speech, that would be a violation of the First Amendment. And there's a long line of Supreme Court cases that confirm that. The question here is that same speech, when used of evidence of discriminatory intent to engage in acts of conduct. And there we have some Supreme Court case law that if that's the purpose of it, that would not violate the First Amendment. And we can get into the details of that distinction from Supreme Court cases, if you like.
Right. And in particular, you mentioned many states have this definition of anti-Semitism codified into their laws. Has that been around long enough to where we have a track record of this definition of anti-Semitism and how it's applied in cases of discrimination or enhanced penalties?
You know, there's no U.S. Supreme Court decision that is interpreting the application of this language to either cases of discrimination or penalty enhancers in criminal cases. That is something that may be coming here as more states adopt it. But at least at this point, the U.S. Supreme Court has not weighed in specifically on this definition.
But you mentioned some comparables at the U.S. Supreme Court, even if not under this definition, things that might give us guidance. What have you seen there?
Yes. So one of the major distinctions the Supreme Court has drawn is between prosecuting a speech in a public forum based on content or viewpoint, which is almost always going to violate the First Amendment, versus using one speech as evidence of discriminatory intent for committing a crime or other illegal conduct. And again, there's a long line of cases with the U.S. Supreme Court saying even if the speech is hateful or offensive in a public forum, that is going to be protected. Now, that's different from what the rules and regulations might be for students in a public school or for public employees or for a private employer firing someone for what they say because the private employer is not bound by the First Amendment like the government is. But there's a long line of Supreme Court cases, including one out of the state of Minnesota called RAV versus St. Paul, where there was a bias motivated disorderly conduct ordinance. So if someone were to engage in hateful speech that arouses anger, alarm, or resentment on the basis of race or religion and a number of other protected class memberships, that was illegal. And the Supreme Court struck that ordinance down, finding that it was content and even viewpoint discriminatory. And again, for the government to punish speech in a public forum because of its content, because of its viewpoints, it's almost always going to violate the First Amendment. Conversely, though, the state of Wisconsin had a case that went before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1993, a case called Wisconsin versus Mitchell. And there it was the state's bias motivated enhancer, which prohibits one from engaging in criminal activity against a membership in a number of protected classes, and basically creates this additional criminal penalty that can be imposed above and beyond what would exist under that criminal statute. Supreme Court said that in that case, what is being punished here is the underlying conduct. Mm-hmm. And so one's statements in that regard that are motivated by bias can be evidence of their intent to commit a bias motivated crime in terms of the conduct. And so, again, that's the big distinction from the Supreme Court. The speech in a public forum has a lot of protection and can't be targeted by the government because of content or viewpoint, even if it's offensive or hateful. But that same speech can be used as evidence of a bias to commit an underlying criminal conduct.
We're talking about a state bill signed into law Friday adopting a formal definition of anti-Semitism. Eric Casper is with us from UW-Eau Claire, director of the university's Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. As we mentioned, there is pushback to this. A group of more than 30 organizations released an open letter pushing back at the bill, worried about censorship. And examples they suggest might be a university campus looking at that Holocaust remembrance definition. One example they give of anti-Semitism is applying double standards to Israel by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanding of any other democratic nation. So saying, hey, people could say, okay, if a professor or a, say, pro-Palestinian protest group on a campus violates, in somebody's perception, that clause, would a student be able to make a discrimination claim? Say, hey, this is creating a hostile campus environment for me. It's violating this anti-Semitism law. Concerns that that could limit speech on campus. How do you sort that out?
Yeah, and this goes to what the law adopts, which is not just the definition from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, but also the act signed into law by Governor Evers. States that it includes the examples that are a part of that definition. And there's a list of several examples. And so it does potentially raise questions if the what is listed in those examples might cause a chilling effect on expression, where it may not be clear for some speakers based on those examples what is prohibited and what isn't. And again, the speech itself in a public forum would have a broad amount of protection under the First Amendment. The law itself comes down to when there has been a claim of some sort of discrimination, or there's been begun a prosecution for criminal conduct. Then can the statements here be used as examples of that biased motivation, that biased intent?
Do you anticipate this law being put to the test much, especially on the discrimination side of things? I think the penalty, the crime penalty enhancers, as you mentioned, have a lot longer precedent. On the discrimination side of these things, do you think we're going to see court cases on these?
That's a very real possibility. At the end of the day, that's where if you're going to see this, not only the definition, but also the examples that accompany the definition, if you're going to see that put to the test, it would be in some sort of case that arises because there's been a claim of discrimination, because it's something gets into court on that front, and it raises the question of are the statements here, do they rise to the level of proving discriminatory intent? The statements themselves in a public forum would be protected by the First Amendment, but are they sufficient proof of that discriminatory intent? And do they have the chilling effect on expression that people will be afraid to say things that would otherwise be protected speech because it could be used against them to prove some other underlying conduct? That's a potential where then we could see a court case develop, and eventually the U.S. Supreme Court may weigh in on that definition.
And then just to make the other part, the penalty enhancer for crimes, more concrete, we could think of an example where someone has targeted people for violence or maybe targeted an institution for vandalism, things like that. And if it's established they did this because the people were Jewish or because this institution was a gathering point for Jewish people, that's where this penalty enhancer would come into effect when they're charged with those crimes. Do I have that right?
Yes. And so then there are additional criminal penalties that could be imposed under state statute if it is because of that type of bias that motivated the crime with membership in a protected class as listed in the statute.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Eric Casper, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, director there of the Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. We've been talking about a new law in Wisconsin signed into effect by the governor last Friday. It specifies a definition of anti-Semitism when it comes to discrimination laws and penalty enhancers in instances of crime.
Coming up, indoor vertical farms were sold as the wave of the future. We'll find out why they often didn't work out, why some did, and we'll visit a vertical farm project in Kenosha.
We got to watch all those big vertical farms fail, so we noticed, okay, this is what they're doing wrong. Here's what we're going to do right.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As farmers plant their crops for a new season, some farms are already rolling with products grown indoors. A decade ago, vertical farms were hailed as the future of agriculture, a cheap way to mass-produce food in urban areas with limited resources.
But the vertical farming revolution has yet to arrive. Vertical farming needs a lot of energy and poses some serious engineering problems. Despite these challenges, there are several vertical farms operating in Wisconsin.
We'll talk to one of those indoor farmers in just a bit, but first let's get an overview of the industry here in the state. Johanna Osterweik is manager of the D.C. Smith Instructional Greenhouse at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in greenhouse management and plant care. Johanna, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Well, tell us about this basic concept for people who haven't encountered the idea. What is a vertical farm?
Yeah, so a vertical farm is literally growing plants on top of each other. You might be familiar with a typical greenhouse where we grow plants like we would in the field, all spread out. But in a vertical farm, we take those indoors, so we're not using natural sunlight. But since we have to light everything anyway, we're also growing them either in racks or trays or stacks on top of each other. But every layer has associated lights with it. So instead of using natural sunlight, we're using electrical energy to create the photons that drive photosynthesis and help the plants to grow.
I remember about 16 years ago, I was a producer here and I booked the late Dixon DePommier. He had a book out called The Vertical Farm. And it seemed like this idea, people were really excited about this, got a lot of investment. What was the appeal, at least of the basic concept of the vertical farm?
Yeah, the first appeal is that you can grow plants anywhere and any time of year. So his proposition was to grow plants, you know, right in downtown in major cities where they're right next to the people who are going to eat them. It's still a great idea. I think something that his book didn't really go into was the limitations. It was very much a think piece. And after 10 to 15 years of this concept being acted on, we're seeing some of the drawbacks and really where the sweet spot is for good vertical farms.
Yeah, we were prompted for this in part by a national article in the New York Times that it looked like a lot of investors jumped into this and tried to do this big time at scale without having worked through some of those challenges and limitations. Do you think there was some maybe unwarranted exuberance early on with this concept?
Well, I think anybody who's drawing in investors is going to build up their idea. And we see that with any sort of new investment idea. It gets people excited and makes them want to support your project. In the last, again, 10 to 15 years, we've then seen the same typical fallout that we do. One interesting thing about this is that a lot of those early investments weren't necessarily in growing produce. A lot of the early investors were drawn in because they wanted to be technology specialists. They wanted to support the company that was going to produce the technology, the systems, the racks, the hydroponics that would then be sold to other growers. So really, they were more interested in the systems, the electrical, the plumbing and ventilation than necessarily growing and selling produce. That actually is a much better profit margin, to be honest. Vertical farming is still farming, and you have very low profit margins for selling produce. So one issue that was seen in those was, well, it's not a great farm. No, but we're working on this technology that we want to sell to other folks. And that was often what was sold to the investors, was not that we were going to be a farm and sell produce, but that we were going to sell the technology to other growers. And that was where the investors were going to make back their money.
On the produce growing side of things, what were some of the biggest challenges that we started to run into as we started to really try to put these things into action?
Well, early on, one of the difficulties was that, again, they were trying to produce technology, so they maybe didn't hire plant specialists and ran into what would maybe to somebody who was a experienced plant grower seemed like obvious things. One opportunity is to convert existing buildings into farms. But you have to take into account how plants grow. Of course, you have the light issue. Hopefully that's obvious. Most of our existing buildings aren't going to be set up to capture natural light, so we have to supplement. But many existing buildings aren't set up for the heavy moisture load that's produced by plants. A lot of the indoor farms are growing hydroponically, so you've got the plants growing in a nutrient-rich water, not in a potting mix or soil. And all of those plants are transpiring. They're moving that water through the roots into the plant and out the leaves, and it ends up in the air. So you end up with a building with really high relative humidity, and you may not have thought ahead about providing sufficient ventilation. And also, a lot of these old buildings are made out of steel. And steel, when it gets exposed to water, rusts. So that was, in some cases, an issue where they, you know, took an old warehouse or a downtown factory and the building started rusting around them. And that wasn't taken into account. So those are some of the things that maybe someone who's interested in a hydroponic rack might not really think about the whole environment in the way that a plant scientist would.
Another challenge is if I want to grow plants out of the ground, a key element is free, the sunlight. Whereas you mentioned, especially if I'm using an older building that isn't all made out of glass or something like that, and I'm having multiple levels, that light is an investment. The energy to produce that light is an investment.
Yeah, so you've got two investments there. You have the purchase price of the lighting fixtures, and then you have the ongoing expense of paying for electricity. And if you're trying to replace the light that plants need, especially in a vertical farm, every layer is another layer of light that you have to provide. Whereas in a greenhouse, you're going to grow in one layer and you're going to capture as much natural light as possible. And for most of the year, you'll have sufficient natural light. Maybe in the deep winter, you'll want to supplement. But in an indoor farm, it's all year round, which is the benefit. You want to be able to grow and produce anywhere at any time. But supplementing that amount of light, it's very, very different from lighting a typical office building. Our eyes adjust to lower light. Plants don't. This is their energy source. This is how they produce the sugars that we like to eat. But without sufficient light, your plants aren't going to do well. And that's an ongoing energy cost.
All that said, there are still vertical farm operations. We'll talk to one from Wisconsin in just a bit. Are there kinds of produce that, hey, it seems like this model might work better than others?
Yes, there's definitely certain kinds of produce that work better than others. And that was one of the, you know, initial ideas where we've seen the limits. You don't want to grow just anything. If this, you want crops that are short so that you can stack them up very high. You're not going to do this with apple trees, for example. So you want plants that are short in stature and that also have a very fast turnover. So the more crops you can harvest in a year, that means the more produce that you have and the more you have available for sale. So you want things with a short life cycle and a small stature. You also want to lean into plants that you get a benefit from producing them close to your consumers. So you want perishable produce, not commodity crops like corn or soybeans. You want things that are going to lose some of their nutritional value through shipping or storage. Crops that store really well, potatoes, carrots, turnips, they're not good candidates for this kind of production. You want things like leafy greens, microgreens, small berries, other kinds of small fruits that, again, you can grow quickly and you lose some of their nutritional value or their quality by shipping them long distances or trying to store them for long periods of time.
Then I imagine I'm not going to have my vertical orchard, my vertical apple orchard anytime soon. The greens seem to work pretty well. I'm guessing there's a mid-range of stuff that, hey, I could grow in my vertical farm, but if I'm competing with places with lots and lots of land and lots and lots of labor, I can't do it in a competitive way. Do I have that right?
Yes, you're right. So again, we see mostly those leafy greens, particularly because the light requirements are lower. So again, fruits, you have to grow the plant, you have to get it to flower, and then you also have to produce this sugary fruit, and that takes a lot of light energy to do. If you're just growing the leaves of a plant, maybe the stems, then you don't need as much light. So growing microgreens or growing lettuces, arugula, that's going to take about half to two-thirds as much light as, say, growing strawberries or tomatoes or cucumbers, which have a full fruit, and you need a longer time to produce those, but also just more energy, hands down. It's interesting that you mention labor. One possible benefit to indoor farms, again, is having a labor source nearby. So when you're out in a more rural area, you may not have as many people for your labor source. Bringing the farm into the city can bring the work to the people. So it's an opportunity for employment, particularly year-round employment. Many farms are seasonal, so you have a lot of work to do during the harvesting and during the planting season, but maybe you have 4 months of winter when you don't have work for folks. So a benefit to an indoor farm would be consistent year-round employment for folks.
Interesting. Johanna, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Johanna Osterwijk is manager of the D.C. Smith Instructional Greenhouse at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes in greenhouse management and plant care. We're talking about vertical farms. Now let's turn to someone who's been running a vertical farm for a few years. Robert Carlson is co-founder of Grow Space Vertical Farm in Kenosha, which grows greens and microgreens. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What was the inspiration for opening Grow Space with some members of your family?
Yeah, so it was started by me, my dad, and my uncle. It's really been a whole family operation, including my grandma and my mom. Everybody's been involved. And what we were seeing is that we thought we could do produce better ourselves in our own house. So it was just me and my dad. We were messing around in the basement with growing plants. And then it's kind of snowballed from there into now we turned an old furniture store into a vertical farm.
And we were just talking to Johanna there. It seems like the sweet spot for produce is in those greens and herbs and microgreens and things like that. Is that where you have put most of your efforts?
Yes. Yes, it is. So we grow leafy greens, microgreens, and herbs. And we are really lucky because we got to watch all those big vertical farms fail. We started in the past 3 years. So we noticed, okay, this is what they're doing wrong. Here's what we're going to do right now that we can see exactly what doesn't work.
All right. Now, what does it take to take, you said an old furniture building. What does it take to turn that into a vertical farm? Sounds like a lot of work to me.
Yes. And it definitely wasn't no work at all. So what we had to do is first we had to waterproof. So it was a furniture store. So they had a drop ceiling that was not going to be good for our water, right? Any humidity or moisture was going to just absorb in there and cause problems. So we switched all of that to waterproof drop ceiling. We sealed a lot of the seams in the building because it is a concrete building, which is also nice. So there's no wood or anything. It does use steel beams, and those we had to paint over, and we had to basically just make sure everything was waterproof, sealed, and tight, so any humidity didn't become a problem. But those steel beams meant that we could put quite a bit of weight onto the floor so we can build out to all the systems that we need.
Now, I want you to paint us a picture. I walk into this former furniture store, now a vertical farm. What do I see?
Yeah. So you literally just walk right into our lobby, and then there is a beautiful window that goes directly into the farm. So the whole wall, right when you walk in, looks into this farm, and is these basically these massive tubes that have all these plants coming out of them. They're actually like beautiful. Like if you saw them at a park or something, they would be like artistic even. And these beautiful towers grow plants coming right out of them. So you basically walk into this wall of beautiful green and these beautiful towers, bright lights. It's a very futuristic looking building when you walk in.
You mentioned learning from the failures of a lot of other operations that kind of went in not knowing what they were doing. Have you run into obstacles early on that you had to say, oh, nope, we didn't get that quite right? What sort of things did you have to overcome along the way?
So we did have to overcome quite a bit. So early on, we figured out the business model that would work best. And that was we're direct to consumer. So we have a storefront, people walk in, people get greens. Then we sell directly to restaurants. So that was the first hurdle is we noticed that, okay, so these basically they're plugging themselves into the system where people can't really appreciate the local greens. So we're direct to consumer. And then what we've run into as well is basically, it's an old furniture store, right? So we run into issues where like, oh, the air conditioning's not powerful enough or the heat's not powerful enough. So a lot of it was, okay, we got the base building correct. Now, oh, we got to do a little more work. We got to put in a new furnace. We got to do this, that, and the other thing to make the space work to grow produce like this.
Now, what do you see as the advantages of vertical farming for products like the ones you're doing and having it, you know, not necessarily out in the country, but in a place like Kenosha?
Yeah. So the big benefits that our customers like is the freshness. That's what everybody absolutely loves. The greens are 2 weeks fresher than they can get from the store. Plus, they have the roots still attached because they're not in soil. That makes the plants last quite a bit longer. And on top of that, we're able to grow without spraying any chemical pesticides, which has some pretty big sustainability benefits, along with the fact that we use a lot less water. At Grow Space, we use around 92% less water, and you can, with hydroponics, get as much as 97% less water usage.
And how about the light issue that I was talking to Johanna about? She said the greens that you're doing, those are the least light hogging of the produce options out there. What do you do to give them the appropriate amount of light?
Yeah, so LED technology is what makes all this possible. It's efficient enough that you can afford the electricity bill every month. And they're able to get the brightness that the plants need to grow. So because of the energy cost, our greens are a little bit more expensive than you would see from the store. But really, that's the only negative that comes from the energy. We get all the benefits of being indoors and year-round for a small premium at the end of the day. So basically, we just pay the electricity bill.
Now, Robert, you've got the old furniture store converted into the vertical farm. is the vision for the future, hey, this is the right size, this is what we want to keep going? Or do you have a notion that, hey, we might want to have a different building, another building to expand this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And what we kind of imagine is that small farms like these will be the standard. Instead of these massive warehouses that get converted into vertical farms, it'll be much smaller buildings like ours, where basically the farm serves just their own community, and that's all it does. So if we were to expand, it would probably be to another building to get that community the greens they need.
Is there another kind of produce you'd want to try, taking the lessons you've learned and the lessons from other failed projects?
Yes, there are. So we would love to do tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, produce like that. But for those, what we'll probably do is we'll probably just do it in a greenhouse instead of doing it indoors, just because of that, you know, that high energy price. Mm-hmm. But we'll see how that does actually end up working out. We're probably a few years away before we're really at a scale that we can, you know, invest in that.
And finally, what are your favorite greens to eat?
My favorite greens to eat. I love our romaine, but that might just be because that's what we grow the most of, so I get to eat the most of it. But it probably is either romaine. I do like our butter crunch as well. Broccoli microgreens as well. Lots of good stuff. I like it all, frankly.
Robert, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Robert Carlson is co-founder of Grow Space Vertical Farm in Kenosha. Earlier, we heard from Johanna Osterwijk, who manages a greenhouse and teaches about greenhouse management at UW-Madison. We've been talking about vertical farms in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a new memoir is a journey of a Wisconsin man searching for his identity, escaping Laos in the secret war, and growing up in Green Bay.
It's an American story. It's an immigration story. It's really a story about all of us. And it's not just a story about my adventure or the experiences that I had.
The author of Bamboo Sun, that's next on WPR News.
Today at 11, we look at the night sky, then UW-Madison's women's hockey team winning the national championship, and finally, a look at jury duty. Join with your questions at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show.
Last week, big tech suffered two unprecedented court losses. In back-to-back verdicts in Los Angeles and New Mexico, juries found social media companies liable for harm to young people. The landmark cases highlighted growing backlash against the effects of tech products on young people from policymakers and parents. Could this be big tech's big tobacco moment? That's next time on 1A.
Coming up next on WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
WPR connects you to people in Wisconsin and around the world. You hear many perspectives and civil conversation every day. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful conversations and the latest news. Thanks for listening.
This is WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As a young boy, Paul Lohr had to flee Laos with his family after his father was assassinated in the violent aftermath of the Vietnam War.
On their perilous journey to Thailand, Paul's mother and sister drowned in the Mekong River, leaving Paul and his other siblings as orphans.
After 2 years in refugee camps, Paul and his family came to the U.S. to start a new life. He and three of his brothers landed in Green Bay.
This story is detailed in Paul Lohr's first memoir, Modern Jungles. Now he's out with a follow-up that picks up his story as a teenager navigating life as a Hmong refugee in Green Bay and growing into an adult with kids of his own.
Paul Lohr is Associate Dean of the School of Education at UW-La Crosse. His new book is called Bamboo Sun, Among Refugees' Search for Identity and the American Dream. Pau, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The title of your new memoir, Bamboo Sun, it has a double meaning. What is the significance of bamboo in Hmong culture and to you personally?
Yes, when we were thinking about coming up with a title that would capture the story, we went through a few titles. And this particular title ended up being the one that we went with. And more than anything else, it's both the bamboo as a plant and the significance of the bamboo and the Hmong culture. In addition to that, bamboo also has a different meaning in Hmong, which is orphan. So we decided that given the nature of the story that we were going to write about, we felt that Bamboo Sun would be an excellent title for this particular book. So when I say we, I'm referring to the Wisconsin Historical Society Press and myself.
You wrote about your early childhood in your first memoir, Modern Jungles. What do you remember most about that journey that you and your siblings took to arrive here in Wisconsin?
You know, that's also a question that I've been asking myself for a very long time. You know, growing up, I've always wondered why these particular memories stay with me. You know, they would play over and over in my head. And so it took a very long time to find a medium in which I felt comfortable to share those memories. But they were always playing in my head.
I think that it was interesting when you write about how you felt like a blank canvas as an orphan without parents. What was that like, that slate, if you will, of who you were starting with as Paul Lohr?
I think when we look at that particular question, obviously, when you look at people's life, when each of us becomes an orphan, is a pivotal moment as to how we understand life. For example, for my siblings, their experiences are quite different than mine. In my case, I think being 5 years old at the time, where you have just enough memories of your parents, but then not enough. Mm-hmm. And even when we were living in some of the tribal villages in Laos, I did not get to see my parents that often. Mm. So when both passed away, as I was talking about that or trying to capture that particular moment and came up with that description, it almost feels as though because you don't have that connection to your origin or your parents sharing with you or that you did not have enough time to really connect with your parents. Mm-hmm. I think I said something to the effect that you feel like you're just blossomed out of thin air, and then you go on this journey. For most part, at least for me anyway, you have to be very independent.
Mm-hmm. You found refuge in soccer. You know, you were this talented midfielder, and then you coached. Why do you think you felt so at home as a soccer player?
Yes, I'm also trying to figure that out. You know, soccer happened to be an activity that for whatever reason, I became very good at it. Mm-hmm. I did not grow up similar to, let's say, some of my teammates who probably started playing when they were 4 or 5, and so they were pretty familiar with it. I did not play organized soccer until I was 13. And so it was a very instantaneous experience, and I just mm-hmm. got into it and somehow excel at it very quickly. And then I just found joy in it because it's an activity that is completely different than some of the more personal experiences that I was going through.
Hmm. You graduate early and in the top 10% of your high school class, but throughout the book, you talk about how you felt like you weren't as smart as the other students. What was the turning point for you in finding confidence and finding your footing?
Yes, I think that particular question really strike at the core of my identity. I don't know whether it's just personal anxiety that I have. I recently had a conversation with a reader who brought up that particular theme throughout the book. And so what I share with the reader was that now that I have some time to think about it, I found that it's actually a positive thing for me to have this sense of inferiority to my peers, that by having that almost anxiety, it helps me to stay more focused on the activities that I was going to do or the tasks and responsibilities that were ahead of me. I think in many ways, for me, that was a positive trait to have, not to be overly confident, not to be overly arrogant about how I go about doing things.
We're talking with Paul Lohr, Associate Dean of the School of Education at UW-La Crosse, about his new memoir. It's called Bamboo Sun. I want to talk about Hmong rituals. And in Bamboo Sun, you write that compared to other Hmong kids, you didn't go to very many traditional ceremonies or rituals, but you did celebrate Hmong New Year in Green Bay, and you also traveled to St. Paul for big Hmong gatherings. What was it like for you going to these events?
For up to that particular point in my life, I had not been around, even when we were in Laos, because I was born into the war and we were hiding most of the time. So I had very minimal engagement with other Hmong individuals. And then even when we got to the refugee camps in Thailand, it was a time in which there was so much hopelessness that I did not find any connection with many of the Hmong people that I was a part of. So it wasn't until I went to that New Year in Minnesota back in the 80s that it was really the first time in which I was among many Hmong people. You know, practically probably around 95% of the people there were Hmong people, and I had never been around so many Hmong people in my life. But at the same time, because of the way that I grew up, you could say that unlike other Hmong children of my age, not having my parents around, I wasn't to a great extent being exposed to Hmong cultural ceremonies and rituals. But I was a part of it enough to have a sense of understanding as to why they're doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But being at that New Year was a strange feeling. To know that you're Hmong, but you don't have, it was difficult to experience the nuance and the subtleties of the particular event.
It almost felt like you were sitting there in the bleachers looking out at the ceremony
as
an observer of someone looking into something. You know, one of my favorite parts of the book is you and Maya and the wedding rituals. And I'm just wondering, what stands out to you about that courtship?
You know, when you're growing up and you get married, you know, particularly if you're going through a very traditional Hmong marriage ceremony, at that age, you're just excited. You know, you're just excited to go through it. And for me—
And you're young.
Yeah. For me, it was just my second time. My marriage was just my second time going through it. But in retrospect, it is a ceremony that has been refined over, you know, the decades and hundreds of years. And so underneath all of the festivity, the drinking, the rituals, the social gatherings, you know, people enjoying the event— embedded within all of that is an incredible emphasis on love, on cherishing your family, cherishing your new family, cherishing your community, that this is the next phase in your life. And so much of it is being passed on at that short amount of time. And it took me a while to understand why so much information, so much life lessons are being passed on in a 1 to 2 day ceremony. And that's because back in Laos, a wedding is one of the few opportunities in which life lessons could be shared. People were just so busy with farming and other activities to survive and to do well that the opportunities to learn are far and in between. And so wedding is one of such opportunity.
You traveled back to Laos and Thailand twice in your adult life, and you write about your Fulbright scholarship in 2004, and then again in 2022 with Maya. You had very different emotional experiences and responses each time. What was different about your most recent trip?
Yes. Growing up, that world that I was born into, and that world that I got a little taste of, growing up, that world seemed so far away, and I wasn't sure if I would ever get back. And then for a very long time as well, you know, up until 2020, that region of Laos where the U.S. had two secret CIA bases. So just to have that opportunity when Laos opened up that area to the outside world and to be able to go back and see for the first time many of the landmarks that I grew up hearing about, you know, the CIA headquarters in Long Kieng, Laos, you know, to see that in person. I saw a few photos of it in the past, but it is nothing compared to being there myself and knowing that my family lived there, knowing that I was born not too far from there, and knowing that that's the center of what led the Hmong to eventually come to the U.S.
And you put flowers in the Mekong River to honor your parents, to honor your sister. That moment, too, must be extremely emotional.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have that opportunity in 2004. Mm-hmm. Even though we were on a Fulbright project, particularly when we got in Laos, we were limited to what we could and could not do. Mm-hmm. And so I had a brief moment right before we were going to come back to Thailand. We were there for a week, and for the entire 1 week, we had very little opportunity to be away from the group or not to have any of the Laotian officials being within the proximity. So I was able to get up pretty early and took that moment to pay homage to the people who perished in the Mekong River.
You have two memoirs now detailing your life, really opening up your internal struggles, your joys through the decades. How is telling your story a gift to Hmong culture and identity and to future generations and clans?
Yes, I think that strike at the heart of the courage that was needed to write the two memoirs. Mm-hmm. I think on the surface level, you know, they're memoirs, and it's you could say it's an adventurous story, and it's a story about my journey. My hope is really that readers get to see beyond that, that the story, the two books mirror not just the Hmong American experience, but it's an American story. It's an immigration story, that it's really a story about all of us. And it's not just a story about my adventure or the experiences that I had.
Paul Lohr, thank you so much for joining us and sharing Bamboo Sun.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
That is Paul Lohr, Associate Dean of the School of Education at UW-La Crosse. We've been talking about his new memoir, Bamboo Sun, which looks back at his teenage years as a Hmong refugee in Green Bay and his journey into finding peace and identity in adulthood. He joined us from our La Crosse studio. Coming up later this week, we'll check out a new book of photos of musicians and venues in Milwaukee.
It's a love letter to the Milwaukee music scene, and we want to hear from you about your local music landscape.
Share some love and promote local music in your area. Do you have favorite performers, favorite venues in your part of the state? Give them a shout out.
Email now at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. That number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.